in their letters to the editor. So Tori seemed to be a lower degree in comparison with the highest state of realization or samadhi. Am I correct? To describe Satori as a pre-glimpse of the supreme state, as written by you, is rather cloudy. Wei Wu Wei's writing on Zen with reference to Balaban's teaching and attempting to bring out a similarity is rather forced. I have not yet found any Zen book prescribing who am I as a koan. I know in Korea there's some monks that use that as a koan.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I?
Okay.
You know, koan, like a question you keep asking yourself until the answer reveals itself in illumination. Have you heard from any Zen or Chan masters or met any such? It is natural for a realized man to advise others to remain in samsara while following the quest, but is there anyone who has realized himself while simultaneously carrying on with all the responsibilities of samsara? Doesn't the sense of non-doership obstruct the whole hearted attention of the actor to his actions? How can he work efficiently unless he considers himself the doer? On the other hand, can't a murderer defend himself on the plea that he is not the doer?
Nice try.
Won't work in court. Latent tendencies, pure and impure, come out in me when I sit in meditation and impede my concentration or holding to one thought. What is still worse, they bring a sense of despair and helplessness and undermine my faith. My mind tells me, what is the use of doing all this? You won't be able to reach the goal till the end of your life owing to your inherent weakness and fault. Please advise me what to do about this. K.K. Ghosh, Calcutta. Editor. The term Satori is used with different content according to the understanding of the writer. But in its true and highest meaning, it is a pre-glimpse of the supreme state, as I said. There is nothing cloudy about that. It is just what it is. There is also nothing forced in Wei Wu Wei's showing a similarity between Zen and Bhagavan's teaching. After all, the goal is the same by whatever road you approach it. The ultimate experience is the same through whatever religion you try to indicate it. So far as I remember, Chan and Zen teaching by Charles Luke and the practice of the Zen by Chen Chi both remark on the use of who am I as a koan. I've also come across instances of it personally. There have been saints in all religions who have carried on a normal life in the world. In India, King Janaka is the classical example. It is not your work that binds you, but your false idea that it is you who are doing it. As if the Brutus in Shakespeare's play were to forget that it is a play and think that he was really the enemy of the stage, Caesar. If he did, he would have the I am the doer illusion and would be shut up in a madhouse. And he would not act his part any more efficiently. Rather less so, because his ego illusion would break through. In the same way, efficient action in your allotted role in life is not at all dependent on the false idea that you are the limited individual who acts. As to your example of a murderer claiming impunity on the plea that he is not the doer, why does he commit the murder? Necessary and harmonious actions can be performed without the intrusion of the ego, without any egoistic motive. But if a murderer has some ego-based motive or believes himself to be judging and deciding that the murder should be committed, he also believes himself to be the doer. Can you imagine somebody who is full of vasanas or latent tendencies attaining realization? Of course not. Therefore, it follows that in the course of practice, they must be squeezed out. It is a good thing to see them. It enables you to recognize them and determine not to be influenced by them anymore. And that way, they gradually are cast out. But it often takes time and requires great perseverance. One should never give way to despondency. It is one of the worst obstacles to progress and has to be fought. Religiously, it is represented as sin, a temptation of the devil. Metaphysically, it is an error. The whole purpose of the practice is to realize that you are not the individual self. So long as you believe that you are, and that this individual self is weak and sinful, how can you realize that you are not? Next question. You stated in your books about Ramana Maharshi that he attained Sahaja Samadhi in his 17th year. They say that because in India, often they say they're 17 when they finish 16. Yeah. They're working on their 17th year, so they're 17.
Yeah.
Here, you get it.
My father
does that, and it's a big, big, big argument. I said you can't call a dollar and 25 $2.
Well, it's just that they give themselves a credit for that year before, when they just start it, not when they finish it.
Koreans call themselves 1 year old when they're born.
Yeah, they call their 1 year old when they're born. They're going a step farther.
So, Yana, you know, she was born in late December. Mm-hmm. So, January 1st comes, everyone turns a year older at that point. So, she's like 3 days old, and she's called 2 years old. Yeah.
Oh no.
Well, yeah, it's nuts.
She must be happy to be an American.
No, she's always saying she's older than she is.
My mother does that.
That he attains the Sahaja Samadhi in his 17th year. Yet, in his biography, B.B. Narasimha Swami quotes on page 94 in the 5th edition saying, "One day, some years ago, I lay down, but I was not in Samadhi." How are the above statements reconciled? Bhagavan said he lay down. I don't know. Let's look that up.
Bhagavan said he was not in Samadhi?
Not in Samadhi. Bhagavan was in a permanent state of Samadhi with simultaneous awareness of the outer world. That is to say, Sahaja Samadhi. Sometimes, however, he sank into Samadhi with this outer awareness. And then we used to say he is in Samadhi. Without this outer awareness, he would sink into Samadhi. Then we would say he is in Samadhi. He also sometimes used to use the expression in this way. In the sentence you quote, he meant merely, "I was not unaware of what was happening." July 1964. Here are the editors. Arthur Osborne, editorial. A Path and a Guide. Sri Jay Krishnamurti, in one of his radio talks, has stated that the saints have brought in all the miseries in this world. You know Jay Krishnamurti, yeah. Right? Yeah. I believe it, you know. What's the use of reciting mantras and things? You can just say Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola.
Really?
We used to say all these things. He asks us not to follow any pattern of life and says that we should live moment to moment. Well, then you don't have to do anything. He also says that we should not have any desire or aspiration in life. I feel that his statements are all confusing and, in short, a dry philosophy. This is somebody sending a question, and he's starting off the editorial by this question by some, you know, reader. Can you kindly enlighten me on the subject? Oh, I feel that his statements are all confusing and, in short, a dry philosophy. Can you kindly enlighten me on the subject? R.S. Shiva Kumar in Madras. And this is the editor writing, I quote this letter at the head of this editorial instead of the letters to the editor section because it goes far to explain the need for this editorial. It is characteristic of appeals for explanation that one receives either orally or in writing from people who are confused at being told by one who was regarded as a spiritual teacher not to accept any spiritual teaching or teacher, but to follow no path, strive for no goal, entertain no aspiration, which is true. I mean, if you can be still, there's nothing more. You
know what I mean?
Just be. So, but there's a lot of preparation required to get to that stage. You know, that you can just stop your mind. Just follow nothing. No one can do that unless they have, you know, have control of the mind. And so they can have control of the mind. Take some effort. Okay, starts his editorial. If, as maintained in my two previous editorials, realization is the purpose of life, it follows naturally that its quest is the first and greatest call upon a man's effort. If life is a path to be trod, quote, from the unreal to the real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality, unquote, as said in the Upanishads, and if, as the masters have warned, it leads through unknown terrain and past dangerous pitfalls, it also follows that a guide is necessary to show the way. Questions of the choice of path and reliability of the guide will be taken up in later issues. First, it seems necessary to dwell on this seemingly so obvious point of a need for accepting a guide and following any path at all. For although more people today than ever before can read about the consummation attainable, not a few do so as dilettantes, without any intention of making the effort to attain it. Unfortunately, this tendency, strong anyway owing to natural inertia, has been apparently sanctioned by the writings and speeches of Jay Krishnamurti, who seems to have made it his life work to proclaim that no effort need be made and no guide follow. Some of his followers, how can there be followers if there is no guide, do indeed explain that he does not really mean that no effort is needed, but that is the impression his books and speeches give, whether intended or not. If the impression is not intended, it's a pity it is given. It is a pity it is given whether intended or not. It is easy to see how someone could come to this conclusion, erroneous though it is. glimpses of higher perception, even of complete self-realization, glimpses called in Zen Satori, do come to a person who is still on the path, or even to one who has not consciously set foot on it and does not even know that there is a path. There are many instances of this. Whole collections of them have been published. The characteristic of them is that they occur spontaneously and most often at a time when one is not making conscious effort. On receiving such a glimpse, a person unacquainted with the teaching of the sages might say to himself, "So, this is it." And no discipline was necessary, and no master. However, such glimpses do not mean that one has attained the realization. The Maharshi was quite definite about this. Quote, "Can the ego, which is in bondage as the mind, become the divine self simply because it has once glimpsed that it is the self? Is this not impossible without the destruction of the mind? Can a beggar become a king by simply visiting a king and declaring himself one?" Unquote. And again, quote, "Realization takes time to steady itself. The self is certainly within the experience of everyone, but not in the way people imagine. One can only say it is as it is. Owing to the fluctuations of the vasanas, the inherent qualities, realization takes time to steady itself. Spasmodic realization is not enough to prevent rebirth, but it cannot become permanent as long as there are vasanas. But if this is to be established, further effort is necessary." Unquote. The brief eternity of such a glimpse may fail to be understood and assimilated, fail to absorb the mind and dissolve the ego. It may thus leave a man unchanged so far as he or others can see. An example of this is Tennyson. He wrote in a letter to a friend, "A kind of waking trance I have frequently had right up from boyhood, when I have been all alone. This has generally come upon me through repeating my own name two or three times to myself, silently, till all at once, as it were, out of the intensity of consciousness of individuality, the individuality itself seemed to dissolve and fade away into boundless being." And this is not a confused state, but the clearest of the clear, the surest of the sure, the weirdest of the weird, utterly beyond words, where death was an almost laughable impossibility, the loss of personality, if so it were, seeming no extinction but the only true life. I'm ashamed of my feeble description. Have I not said the state is utterly beyond words? Unquote. He further indicates a characteristic paradox of this experience in a pregnant line occurring in an otherwise drab passage. The princess, quote, "And all things were and were not," unquote. And yet even though, as a poet, he must be supposed to have had more intuition than most people, he never understood it. And it seems to have enlightened neither his life nor poetry. A man may even forget and deny it. Koestler described in his early autobiography how much an experience of certitude came to him when he was a prisoner in the Spanish Civil War, expecting to be shot. And yet, years later, in his superficial investigation into samadhi in The Yogi and the Robot. Has anybody read that book? No. The Yogi and the Robot.
Have you read it?
Never heard of it. Yeah. No. If I read this before. No. The Yogi and the Robot he showed himself skeptical of the very possibility of it. Only in very rare cases does such a pre-glimpse become permanent and stabilized. One such case was that of Ramana Maharshi. And he was quite insistent that when it does not remain continued, persistent effort is needed. It is said by Krishnamurti that one should abide in the true state of effortless, choiceless awareness, and that effort only disturbs this. You know, a lot of teachers say that.
But you need effort.
Yeah, like in Papaji. You should tell everybody, you don't have to do anything, you're already the self. True. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've got a big crowd coming around. They like that. But can one? About this also, the Maharshi was quite definite. Effortless and choiceless awareness is our real nature. If we can attain that state and abide in it, that is all right. But one cannot reach it without effort, the effort of deliberate meditation. All the age-old vasanas, inherent tendencies, turn the mind outwards to external objects. All such thoughts have to be given up and the mind turned inwards, and that for most people requires effort. Of course, every teacher in every book tells the aspirant to keep quiet, but it is not easy to do so, unquote. If anyone doubts this, let him try for himself instead of weighing the statement of one teacher against that of another. Let him sit down and maintain effortless, choiceless awareness of being without allowing any distracting thoughts to come in, and see whether he can keep it up for even 30 seconds. If not, let him not speak of stillness as an alternative to effort. Stillness is only achieved through effort. Another argument used is that one actually is the self, since there is no other. One must be. So why strive to be the self? And they add, the Maharshi himself said so. Certainly he did. But he also exhorted us to strive to realize this and not just understand it theoretically, partly perhaps to guard against the sila and charidis on either side of the true path. Sila. What is it? Is it S? What? Skyla? S-C-Y-L-L-A.
Sila.
Sila and Charibdis.
Charibdis.
You heard of this?
Charibdis, no. Sila, yes.
Charibdis on either side of the true path. On the one hand, that no effort is needed, and the other, that a man, by his own effort, can create or attain the true state. He sometimes represented the effort required as a negative process. Quote, all you have to do is to disrealize unreality and reality remains. Unquote. This is a traditional explanation given by the sages. If the clouds are removed, the clear sky remains. If water lilies have overgrown a pond, they only have to be removed for the water to appear. It does not have to be created. The attitude taken up by some Western exponents of Zen, that all you have to do is to be spontaneous, is another more subtle example of the same error, that no effort is needed, for spontaneity itself is not easy. Or rather, there is a lower and a higher spontaneity. A child of three toddles into a room and bangs spontaneously on the piano, and there is a hideous din. An expert pianist plays spontaneously and there is music. The difference between the two spontaneities is years of effort and discipline. Much is made in Western Zen of sudden enlightenment coming as a result of a blow or a cryptic saying. Enlightenment, of course, does come suddenly in any religion, just as does the pre-glimpse I spoke of at the beginning of this article. But it only comes to one who has this realized unreality to such an extent as to be receptive to it. One who has not received 100 blows or has not or have his nose tweaked daily without waking to reality. One who has not may receive 100 blows or have his nose tweaked daily without waking to reality. As for spontaneity, a master in any religion behaves with childlike spontaneity. As Christ put it, he is like a little child. The naturalness of Bhagavan was as striking as his grandeur. But to try to imitate this would only make one a poser. Hanging apples on a tree does not make it an apple tree. What is needed is to attain the inner state that manifests outwardly as true spontaneity. And this can only be done by persistent and disciplined effort. He's explaining Krishnamurti saying about not doing, just being the solid. Someone sent him a question relating to that. So he put the question, and this is the answer.
Who is this?
Arthur Osborne, editorial 1964. You know. But even if effort is needed, why a guru, some ask? Once one grants that the sages knew what they were talking about when they said it was an arduous path beset with dangers, it should be obvious that it is a safer to be guided on it by one who has gone before and knows the way. That is one explanation. Another is that the guru is a man of power. Grace flows through him to strengthen and support his followers. If you are serious about assaying a tremendous task, why lightheartedly reject aid, which has always been considered necessary in all but very exceptional cases? If it had been found that oxygen is needed to climb Everest, why set out to do it without? And this is more than Everest. Intellectuals are apt to consider only the first of these two explanations and to think of a guru as one who explains the hidden mysteries and removes their philosophical doubts. But the infusion of power and removal of impediments is an even more important function, and indeed may in some cases suffice with no theoretical instruction at all. An illustration of this, I will quote from a powerful but little-known guru of recent times, an almost illiterate Bengali woman who spoke no other language and yet had disciples who were not Bengalis and to whom she could not speak. That is Sri Sharada Devi, the widow of Ramakrishna. Her quote, I guess. The power of the guru enters into the disciple, and the power of the disciple enters into the guru. That is why when I initiate and accept the sins of the disciple, I fall sick. It is extremely difficult to be a guru. Unquote. In another occasion, when someone protested against her allowing an unworthy person to touch her feet, since it would cause her pain, actual physical pain and burning, she said, "No, my child, we are born for this purpose. If we do not accept other sins and sorrows and do not digest them, who else will? Who will bear the responsibilities of the wicked and the afflicted? Unquote.
The one saying of hers that I like so much was, she said to one disciple, whenever you're in distress, just say to yourself, I have a mother. Mm-hmm. I think it's so nice.
And on another occasion, when someone protested against her allowing an unworthy person... Okay, I said that. In Christianity, Christ is, quote, he that taketh upon himself the sins of the world, unquote. And in Hindu mythology, Shiva is represented as blue-throated from the poison of human iniquity that he swallowed. What then of the modern craving to be self-reliant? Who is the self on which you are to be reliant? That very ego, that very individual being, whom you believe to be a phantom and hope to dissolve into nothingness. And who is the guru? How can anyone outside you guide you to the self of you? The guru is not outside you. The essential guru is the self in your heart. The Maharshi often reminded his disciples that the outer guru exists only to awaken the inner guru in the heart. When that has been done, he ceases to be necessary. Can one then not dispense with the outer guru? So long as you feel that you exist in the body, so long will the guru also exist outwardly, and his grace strengthen and refresh you in your efforts. When you feel, not merely recognize theoretically, but really feel constantly, that you are not the body, and feel inner grace and awareness surge up from your own heart, the guru will also not need to be manifested outwardly in the body. But as long as you live, in fact, on the plane, on one plane, it is no use arguing from another. Here's a small quote from Joel Goldsmith, a New York Jew, became Christian Science healer, and then he became like a spiritual teacher. If truth is not actively maintained in consciousness, life becomes one of futility, awaiting for something to happen. The hoped for and long awaited spiritual awakening, which many people desire, but towards attainment of which they make no effort, does not happen except perhaps once in 100 years, or possibly to one out of 1,000,000 persons. And even then, as we know from the history of many to whom it has happened, it is of no value because it came unexpectedly without understanding and without any idea or knowledge of how to recapture it. The degree in which truth is kept active in consciousness determines not only the degree of our ultimate spiritual illumination, but the time of it. Could be tomorrow, next week, next month, or next year. But that moment we determine by whether or not truth is kept active in our consciousness for an hour on Sunday or an hour every day, 2 or 3 minutes out of every hour in the day, or ultimately without almost ever every breath we breathe. It is possible to pray without ceasing. If we know the inspired passages of Scripture and those of mystical and metaphysical writing, if we are willing to remember to apply them, and above all, if we are able to overcome the inertia of the human mind. Ramana Sadguru by G. Allen. This is some devotee, by the way. Sri Bhagavan has said of Arunachala in his Palikam, my Lord, when anyone asks me of your greatness, you hold me motionless like a statue with bowed head. Similarly, I Similarly, do I find that my mind felt numb when I would write about Bhagavan Sri Ramana? Who is our Arunachala Ramana? He himself gave the answer when he wrote, quote, "In the recess of the lotus heart of all, from Vishnu downwards, there shines as pure consciousness the Paramatma, who is the same as Arunachala or Ramana," unquote. Sri Bhagavan was gracious enough to refer to this once when I was taking leave of him to return to my native place. He said, quote, "Have you seen this morning mail? Someone has written that Arunachala Ramana is everywhere, so that whenever he has an urge to come here, that feeling makes him postpone his visit," unquote. Humbling, I replied, expressing my own point of view, which was quite different from that expressed in the letter. "Bhagavan, in this body I have realized you in your divine form as my guru, my Bhagavan. Once having seen you, neither I nor any other can shake off the feeling of love for your divine form," unquote. At that time, I was attending to the ashram correspondence. I drafted a reply to the letter in question, showed it to Bhagavan for his approval, and sent it off. Footnote: Bhagavan never wrote letters. All letters were answered punctually the same day, the replies being drafted in the office and submitted to him for his approval or correction. His remark about this letter must have been his parting message to me, as it turned out that this was to be the last time I ever saw him. Sri Bhagavan also affirmed his universal nature in the following manner in his benedictory verse to Atma Sakshatkara, which he translated to Tamil, quote, "Atma Sakshatkara, which was taught by Ishwara to his son Guha, is now propounded in Tamil by that same Lord, the dweller within me, the ancient, the supreme," unquote. "The power of Bhagavan is eternal and above all siddhis. A siddhi is transient, but Bhagavan is a healer whose cure is permanent. His kindless aspiration, he kindles aspiration in the heart of those who come to him, oblivious of their eternal nature, turns their mind inward with the inquiry, 'Who am I?' and helps them to realize the self for whom the word I stands. The main type of upadesha used by Bhagavan is silence, as it was with Dakshinamurti of old. Divine bliss permeated those who sat around him. In this silence, the doubts of his devotees are cleared up, and their questions are either answered or fade away and cease to appear necessary. This silence is of a dynamic force, eternal, universal in nature. Nevertheless, though universal, it is centered in the ashram where he lived, at Tiruvannamalai, at Arunachala, the spiritual center of the world. Here again, there are the two points of view, both true, although apparently contradictory. Sri Ramana's grace acts always, but inscrutably and in diverse ways. We find his gracious and profound utterances in the small volume of his collected works, in collections of his reported sayings, and in books about him. That is food for the mind. But when the mind is turned inward by the inquiry, "Who am I?" he is there in the heart, ever watchful, ever helpful. He does not allow the soul to get drowned, but draws it mercifully to his eternal abode. Sometimes he appears in dreams and visions, blessing and encouraging his old devotees and others too who never saw him in the body. In the marital garland of letters to Sri Arunachala, he wrote, quote, "Mere thought of thee has drawn me to thee, O Arunachala," unquote. Alluding to this once, I said, "Bhagavan, the thought of Arunachala drew you here, but is it not still more wonderful that you drew us here who had never heard of you and lapped off our ego. His answer was his usual gracious and benign smile. Sri Ramana, the answer was his usual gracious and benign smile. Sri Ramana is an ocean of nectar, teeming with kindliness. He is gracious and forgiving. Were he to dwell on our slips and faults, we would be lost. But ignoring them, he still guides us. He instills hope when we are dejected and stretches out his supporting hand to lead us toward the goal. The only thing required of us are perseverance and faith in him.